Chapter 29. Ascension. Steel clanged against stone as Kyrus's sword bounced to a stop against the wall of his bedchamber, missing a bookshelf by a mere hand's breadth. He winced at the sound, reflexively bringing his hands, one of them smarting from where the sword was bashed free of his grasp, to cover his ears. Once the noise stopped, he hung his head and went to retrieve it. "We have time for another go of it," Kyrus said, flexing and clenching his fingers to work the sting out of them. "Suit yourself. I've got nothing to do today but show up to the coronation, and that's not till sunset," Tanner retorted, grinning. The Vaedran incarnation of the Tanner whom Brannis had met in Tellurac was, if possible, a smugger, cockier, less disciplined version than the one who led the free and easy life of a coinblade. He had a slouch about him, not of the hunched and self-conscious type, but rather the casual, relaxed posture of someone who does not feel the need to make any effort in order to excel. He could lean against a wall from the middle of a room. "Might have picked a later hour for it," Varnus called out from Kyrus's desk chair, which creaked under the bulk of the giant guard captain as he leaned it back on two legs, watching the two men spar. "My stomach's craving dawn feast, but I couldn't very well miss this spectacle." Kyrus brought his sword up to guard position, locking gazes with Tanner, or at least attempting to. Tanner's gaze wandered the room, his sword bared but resting across his shoulder in a loose grip. "Whenever you're ready, boss," Tanner said, covering a yawn with his off hand. Kyrus launched a probing thrust, but Tanner stepped aside and back, well out of reach. A follow-up thrust got Tanner to take the sword off his shoulder, and the more expertly wielded blade picked off the attack with contemptuous ease. Three more attempts at attack were met with increasing levels of defense, until the parries themselves were putting Kyrus on the defensive, pulling his blade back to guard himself against a counterattack he knew would come as soon as Tanner grew bored of defense. "You could at least make it look like you're trying," Kyrus complained, feeling the burning in the muscles of his arms that alerted him that his sword was slowing. Tanner's sword whipped around in response, sliding past Kyrus's awkward attack and slamming into the side of his neck. "Dead," Tanner said with a shrug, "or would be if you didn't have a shield spell like the walls of Rainsdark, from about 2 seasons ago, anyway."
"Aye, Brannis, give those little twigs dangling from your shoulders a rest," Varnus added. "Even dead men need a good dawn feast."
"It ought to be here soon," Kyrus said. "I arranged for a full dawn feast to be brought up. I have things to discuss with both of you besides swordplay." A disturbance in his wards alerted Kyrus to the arrival of their meal. The servants had been taught the proper spot to knock where the wards would not suffocate any hint of noise from the outside. Two young cook's assistants carried covered platters that smelled of fresh-cooked meats and citrus. A young serving girl brought a pitcher of ale and tankards, and a group of porters carried in a small table and chairs for them.
"I had half expected field rations after last night's bread with a bit of water to wash it down with. Ale in the morning, my sort of dawn feast," Tanner said once the assemblage of servants had departed. "We don't allow that dried leather you soldiers eat past the palace gates," Varnus said, tankard in hand already.
"Well, I meant that with the coronation tonight, I expected the servants to be too busy to make such a diversion for us."
"Well, I have a bit of say in such things," Kyrus said with a sly grin. "As to the selection, I picked a few of the things that seem to taste close enough to Tellurac fare that it does not bother me. The spices are all wrong. The game fowl seems a bit foul. Many of the fruits here do not seem sweet enough, and I do not know what you do to the waters in Vaedrus to make the fish taste too oily. The citrus is strong enough to overpower any strange flavors, though, and bacon? Well, the bacon tastes just like home."
"And the ale? You prefer it over mulled wine or even just plain water with breakfast?" Tanner asked, humoring Kyrus's treatise on the local cuisine.
"Well, it took a few days to realize the cause, but the drinking water was giving me the runs. The wines here feel grimy in my mouth, like they could have used a straining through a fine cloth. Do they leave the skins ground up in it or something of the like?" Kyrus asked. Gut me if I know, Varnus replied. At least you've got ale, eh?
Well, the ale was merely the best among bad options, Kyrus replied, lifting his eyebrows and his tankard in unison. Kyrus waited until they had settled in and begun their meal in earnest before deciding it was time to change to more delicate topics. The wards in the room ought to have given them privacy enough should anyone attempt to eavesdrop. Kyrus could only hope that he would be perceptive enough to notice should anyone test themselves against those wards.
So how fare you two on the other side? Kyrus asked, leaving the question open-ended, lest he get an exact answer that left out details. If he was to set up his own private network of spies, he ought to at least act like a master of intrigue.
Well, Captain Zane wanted me to convey to you that this whole war was just a simple misunderstanding, Tanner said, causing Kyrus's eyes to widen in surprise. You see, there were these detailed orders on how not to launch a war against us, and a splotch of ink happened to fall on the not bit.
Stow it, Jester, be serious, Varnus chided Tanner, giving him a backhanded slug on the shoulder. Stalyard hasn't even got you to Zane's ship yet, and we all know it.
Hey now, I'm stuck for days on a ship in the middle of the Katamic with a bunch of pirates. I got nothing to do but swill rum and gamble at dice and cards. Can't even properly enjoy it, though, worrying about a knife in the back, shield or no shield. I think I'm entitled to piss in Brannis's ale a bit in return, Tanner said. Kyrus paused mid-sip, giving Tanner a narrow-eyed glare.
Figure of speech, of course, Tanner said.
Well, at least there you've got rum and cards, Varnus commented. Did either of you hear that there were three bodies found last night? Separate incidents scattered about Cadrus, but all three were sorcerers.
No, Kyrus answered, Varnus having taken the entirety of his attention away from Tanner's jests. I have not left these quarters yet today.
City guards were handling it, but the inner circle pulled them off the job. Dolvain assigned a bunch of sorcerers to look into it.
Anyone important? Tanner asked.
No more so than a typical sorcerer, I would say. 2 6th circle I've never heard of, and a 4th circle by the name of Cayman, who tried courting one of Juliana's cousins a while back. Didn't know him well, but I knew his face well enough to find him in a crowd.
Magrin assassins, that'd be my guess, Tanner speculated. He mimed a dagger thrust to the back. More of those invisible fellows like tried to snuff out Warlock Rashan and Mr. Tellurak here.
No, Kyrus began, causing Varnus and Tanner to wait expectantly in the heavy pause he left as he gathered his thoughts. I think not. The coronation is tonight. Not everyone has been enamored of the choice of successor to the throne. The city is packed to the rafters with visitors despite the war going on, meaning that there are likely many more sneakblades about than usual, coming in with the noble guests.
You think this is the start of a coup? They were no powerful or influential sorcerers, the three victims. It seems an unlikely first open move for one, Varnus said.
Well, McGrin's already tried twice, so why not assume it was them until you got a better idea, Tanner countered.
I do have a better idea, Kyrus answered, his voice hollow, his gaze vacant, as if he were musing on his own thoughts rather than conversing. Rashan has said since before Rainsdark that he suspected plots against him. I have reason to believe that to be true. This could mean that, in the shadows, sides are being drawn among the Imperial Circle.
Sides? What sides? Tanner asked,
his bean-shaped face scrunched up even farther in a look of confusion and concern. Those who support Rashan and those who would rather see him replaced as regent by someone other than his hand-picked bastard descendant of his old friend Emperor Liad. Varnus cast Kyrus a wary glare.
Which side are we on?
Mine, I am hoping, Kyrus replied. As to which side I have picked, I have not picked at all yet. By rights, I ought to support Rashan, since he is the reason I am in this position at all. Grand Marshal, that is, not me being switched with Brannis. That was my own doing.
So the dead sorcerers, which side were they on? Tanner asked.
If I knew that, I might be able to tell you which side I was on, Kyrus answered.
The corridors of the palace teemed with servants intent upon tasks they surely had been told were crucial to the coronation ceremony. A misplaced tablecloth, or one pheasant too few for the banquet, and we would have to find a new emperor, Juliana thought sourly as she wove her way through the press of bodies. A few who recognized her gave way and allowed her to pass, but she was wearing a plain gray tunic and men's breeches, nothing that would single her out as a member of the imperial circle, let alone the regent's oath daughter. Still, being caught up in the tide of busy humans was better than dwelling alone in her room, or passing idle chatter with the folk who made a habit of lounging about the palace. If nothing else, her current circumstance was a temporary inconvenience until she could escape the confines of the palace grounds, and hide out by the waterfront until her duties required her back for the ceremony.
"Julie!"
She heard a shout from behind her down the hall. It was a woman's voice, but not a very feminine one. Juliana slouched slightly and continued walking, hoping her pursuer would lose track of her amid the throng. Being an archon had its disadvantages, though. Even slouching, she was taller than most of the peasant folk about her, and her reddish-gold hair shone like a lighthouse beacon among the drab brunettes and pale blondes surrounding her.
"Julie, wait!"
the voice came again, closer than last time. Even if she had not recognized the timbre and tone, the use of the disused diminutive form of her name would have narrowed the list of suspects to a short list. Classmates from the academy who had been too much older or stronger than her to beat until they stopped calling her that. She gritted her teeth, paused, and waited for Brannis's older sister to catch up to her. Aloysia Soloran was almost Juliana's height, but shaped nearer to Soria's more muscular frame, with a mannish jawline and wide blue eyes that offered a challenge wherever they looked. Those eyes swept up and down Juliana as she got close enough for the crowd to part between them.
"Washerwoman got your circle garb?
Rinsing the sweat stains and the smell of ale away before the coronation ceremony?" Aloysia asked with a smirk.
"I'm sure I could loan you a gown if you would prefer, though it might hang a bit loose on you."
"You're one to talk," Juliana retorted, eyeing the elaborate nest of braids curled about Aloysia's head.
"Last time I saw you primped like this was for your own wedding. You usually just go about like a man who grew his hair long and stuffed a pair of melons into a gown. I have work to do and I'm dressed for it."
"Work? You? I had thought your father got you that appointment as contraband inspector just so you had an excuse to hang about in disreputable ale halls all day."
"I'm good at my job. I just don't do it the way everyone would expect. At least I am suited to mine. You look like the serving maid or the scribe for the inner circle when you're all gathered together," Juliana retorted.
She would be gutted before she let Aloysia run her to ground verbally. Aloysia Soloran fumed silently for a moment, lips pressed tight in an obvious effort to remain civil, or at least as civil as either of them had been to that point. She drew a deep, steady breath. She took Juliana by the arm and pulled her aside, dragging her into one of the guard rooms near where they had been standing.
"What do you think you're doing?"
Juliana demanded, twisting free of Aloysia's grasp. It took a degree of self-control to keep from using a Tejuan technique to flip the elder sorceress to the ground, breaking her wrist in the process. The door slammed shut behind them. Juliana knew Aloysia was holding it closed telekinetically, in lieu of warding it.
"We need to talk."
"We were talking out there," Juliana noted.
"Was it you?"
Aloysia demanded.
"Was what me?"
"The three murders last night. Three dead sorcerers the night before the coronation. The inner circle are having fits over it."
"What would make you think that?"
"Rain's dark. I heard the stories and pieced it together. Goblin assassin in the castle dead by your hand the night before the battle. A half dozen guards and sorcerer Rugler McGarren dead by dagger, but no dagger to be found on the assassin's body. After the battle, Duke Peloton found dead. Same wounds. Dagger left by his body."
"So why do you assume it was me?"
Juliana asked, crossing her arms in front of herself defiantly.
"I brought my theory to Rashan, and he agreed. He had assumed it was you all along," but did not care enough to mention it. I got the impression he was not bereft over the Duke's death, and I decided not to press him on it. If I did, you think that means I'm responsible for those murders last night? You do not just hire any jackblade out of the alleys and set him off on a merry romp among the circle. Whoever killed 3 in one night knew what they were doing around magic. Thanks, I think, but I had nothing to do with them. And if I had, what had you planned to do about it?
Aloysia's eyes unfocused for a moment.
You are carrying those daggers my brother gave you as a wedding gift, Aloysia said, making an accusation of it. What would you have done if I had said I was going to tell Rashan it was you? Attack me? You are sixth circle, and content to remain so. I am inner circle. I could crush you like a gnat if you tried it. Well, it is a very good thing that I had nothing to do with those murders, then, isn't it?
Juliana said. Faster than Aloysia could react, a pair of daggers appeared in Juliana's hands, blades poised beneath the startled sorceress's ears. Each of Aloysia's dangling earrings was delicately draped over a bared, dragonbone blade.
I would hate to have gotten hurt.
Slowly, Juliana lowered the blades and returned them to the recesses beneath her tunic. Aloysia had managed no more than a startled intake of breath. Swallowing and letting out a shuddering breath to calm herself, Aloysia broached the subject one further time.
There are forces at work to tear down Warlock Rashan and return control of the Empire to the Circle. Which side are you on?
Aloysia asked, more politeness evident in her tone than before she had been frightened.
I don't think I am quite the kind either side is interested in recruiting, if indeed there are sides at all. I've heard Rashan rant about conspiracies before, but I assumed he was paranoid. It is one of the perks of being important, as far as I can tell. I assume you have sided with Rashan, since he's the only reason you aren't still third circle?
Yes, the whole family is with Rashan, but I am less certain of the Archons. The death of High Sorcerer Gravis sits ill with them.
Yeah, I was never fond of my grandfather, but he was my blood. Still, even if I don't side with him, I'm certainly not fool enough to side against Rashan. Besides, I'd hate to have to get my oath sister's blood all over my nice new daggers. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have places to be.
Juliana shouldered her way past Aloysia and found the telekinesis spell that had held the door was no longer doing so. She tried to gather her thoughts while she wove through the tangle of servants headed for the palace gates. She had heard of the murders, of course. They were the talk of the city that morning, with rumors spreading like the morning sunlight, but had not thought it to be a fight within the circle for control of the Empire. Kyrus arrived at Rashan's office to find Celia waiting there in his stead. She sat demurely, legs crossed, hands in her lap. She started to get up when Kyrus entered, but a look of disappointment crossed her features as she sat right back down again.
I had thought Rashan was back, she said, by way of apology. She stifled a yawn.
Glad to know where I rate, Kyrus commented with an amused grin. I thought you were going to be working for Caladrus now.
I do, and he often has me running errands between the two of them, but I have personal business with the warlock.
She raised her eyebrows and turned her head a bit, as if challenging Kyrus to ask about it. Well, he had left word that he wanted to see me, so I assumed he would be here. Do you know where he is?
He is the busiest man in the Empire. He could be anywhere. He's even busier than you, Brannis, though I would wager you do not think so often. You can wait here with me if you like, Celia offered.
I suppose I will have to, Kyrus replied, blushing as he realized how that must have sounded. I meant that I have a lot of things to do as well, as you mentioned, but I cannot just ignore Rashan's request. Kyrus walked over behind the desk and sat down.
You should not sit there, Celia said. I would not want to see Rashan get angry.
It is the only other chair here. It is not as if he would kill me for taking his seat anyway. He's not quite that temperamental. Kyrus was only partially certain on that last point. Celia said nothing after that, just sat there looking nervous. She did not look directly at Kairos, but as he sat at Rashan's desks, surrounded by confidential reports on troop movements and Kadran political affairs, his eyes were drawn to her.
The hair does not quite match, he thought, comparing her to his mental image of Abile. The build is close, very close, but Celia is a touch thinner, and her breasts are higher. The nose seems about right. The eyes are identical. Celia's teeth are perfectly straight and white, while Abile's are more natural-looking. She sounds like Abile, Kairos added mentally, though he knew his ear for such things was poor. It seemed a horrible question, but he had to ask it of himself anyway. If I was Abile and had the magic to do so, what would I change about myself?
That was the crux of it.
You keep looking over this way, Celia mentioned.
Kairos turned his gaze away and blushed anew. There are not many places to look in here. It is a small office. I cannot help where my eyes are drawn, Kairos said. He tried to focus his attention on a guest list for the reception after the ceremony.
Had a change of heart, perhaps? Celia asked,
a playful note sneaking into her voice, accompanied by a shy smile. Kairos's brow furrowed in genuine contemplation.
Have I?
A change of heart would imply that he had not been attracted to her ever since noticing the resemblance she bore to Abile when he first saw her through Brannis's eyes. Or it would imply that he had been initially attracted to her but was no longer. No. Kairos's voice went hoarse on him. He cleared his throat and tried again. No, I have not. He smiled in her direction. She smiled back, showing those perfect teeth that reminded him that even if she was Abile in Tellarac, she was different here.
There is nothing in our way, you know, Celia said, obviously having guessed at how Kairos had meant his answer.
She was smart, one of the things he admired in her. There are a great many things in the way. Again, as you pointed out, I am busier than anyone except perhaps the warlock.
No one is making you sketch up new runes to build airships with. You have no duties to the circle. Just manage the army, which should be enough work for any man, and leave the rest to the others. And, well, do not make yourself any more of a target than you already may be.
What do you mean by that? Kairos asked.
Brannis, think about it. There has already been one attempt on your life, Celia explained. Now there is someone killing sorcerers right here in Cadrus.
What has Caladrus heard? Kairos asked. She was his assistant now, so the idea that she might have special knowledge of the attacks was not unreasonable.
Dolvain is the one investigating it. He has said nothing to Caladrus that I am aware of.
Kairos was about to ask whether she knew of factions within the circle, and which the victims might have belonged to. But Rashan chose that moment to arrive back at his office.
Ah, Brannis, good of you to wait for me. I hope you took care of a few of those annoying reports for me while I was delayed,
Rashan jested, his mood better than Kairos was accustomed to seeing it.
Celia, my dear, your presence is a bit more of a surprise. What brings you to my offices on a frenetic day such as this?
It is the dreams again, she replied, casting a quick sidelong glance at Kairos as if to see how much she ought to say in front of him. I slept all night, but woke exhausted. My mind was occupied all night as if stuck watching a play that ran from dawn to sunset.
What is it that you would have me do for you? Rashan asked. End the dreams? Tell you what they mean? Reassure you that you are not losing your mind?
Well, maybe all three, but in reverse order, Celia answered.
Without knowing more of them, I would venture that there is little risk to your sanity. Folk have dreamed all manner of things, and if they say nothing of it upon awakening, it may as well never have happened. From kings to killers, warriors to lovers, all within the span of a night, all within the confines of the same head. You may do what you like within it. As to the meaning, you ought to search through them yourself for that. Dreams are an insight into your own life. If, as you mentioned to me once before, you are the same person in your dreams night after night, you ought to begin by learning more about this dream self. As to ending them, there is only one way I know of to end dreams permanently. Stop sleeping.
Well, that is not much use to me now, is it? Celia asked in a plaintive tone. I have many demands upon my time, else I would be willing to discuss your dreams with you at length. However, those demands are lessened greatly in the deep hours of the night, when sensible folk are sleeping. You can come back then, and seek both refuge from dreaming, and maybe a more detailed insight, if you can put more details into your description. Now, if you would allow, Brannis and I have matters to discuss that I would prefer my great-nephew to hear about when I am ready to tell him myself. Sorry to have bothered you, Warlock. Celia stood, gave a small curtsy to the Warlock, and took her leave. She cast a hesitant glance over her shoulder at Kyrus just before closing the door behind her. Ignoring what formal protocol would have dictated, Rashaan slumped down into the chair Celia had vacated, leaving Kyrus seated at his desk. Interesting girl, is she not? Rashaan asked, lacing his fingers behind his head as he lounged, stretching out diagonally on the chair. Did you ever ask her about that name you had, Abelay? Yes, she accused you of having revealed it to me. I am still not entirely certain she is Abelay, but my suspicions are growing. Well, keep that attitude of suspicion. Easy trust is a bad habit to fall into. It is easy for me to be flippant about it, given my current condition and lack of a direct link to Tellurac these days. You, on the other hand, do well to doubt. The girl you described to me from Tellurac sounded like a sweet, innocent thing. But Celia is a clever girl. If the two are one in the same, and she fully realizes it, their personalities will drift together over time. That sweet, young, innocent girl might find a way to get hold of you by the manhood in one world, and own you in both. Positioned well, blackmail between worlds can be brutally effective. It is the look that makes me doubt. She is so close, but there are a number of small things that are off. I cannot tell how much could be explained by magic, Kyrus said, hands spread wide in a helpless gesture. Most sorceresses get around to hammering out any blemish they find in their appearance, though some are more vain about it than others. A few carry around some flaws as marks of pride that their looks are natural. The sensible ones come to realize that menfolk are not as picky as they imagine them to be. Celia, I would place among the first group. Can you tell by looking what has changed? Kyrus asked. Not if she is any good at it, no, Rashaan responded. I have more important matters to attend to today. Your little personal mystery can occupy some other chunk of time, separate from my day. So which shall it be, then, coronation or murderous intrigue? Kyrus asked. No one ever said we could not combine the two, Rashaan joked. But actually, I wish to speak to you of what will be taking place after the coronation. The reception? Kyrus ventured a guess. No, me leaving to go to war. Oh. And you taking my place overseeing affairs in Cadrus. Silence. And silence in reply. Rashaan only smiled. You are really going to leave me to run everything in your absence? Kyrus asked. I could not leave Brannis in charge, even though he had the brains for it. You, though, Brannis, are a bit of a different tale. Brannis would have had to worry about plots directed against him, magical manipulation, or someone just straightforwardly turning him to ash. You are raw, largely untrained, but potentially dangerous enough to give anyone pause. You can bully them into obeying you if transferred authority is not enough to win their cooperation. But what about the new emperor? What if he wants you to remain? You've been protecting him all this time. I have hammered it into his head since I got him selected that once he's emperor, he should order me into the field to clean up the mess this war is becoming. We can protect him from Magrin well enough. Once he's emperor, I will cease worrying so much about threats from within. Killing a crowned emperor is a whole different matter from disposing of an appointed heir who did not enjoy wide support. Speaking of threats from within, what about those murders last night? Kyrus asked. A tantrum, perhaps, by those who disliked my choice of emperor. None of the three who were killed were particularly important, but I counted them among my supporters. Had they managed to kill Caladris or Aloysia, maybe I would have taken them seriously, but I do not see a threat in this. Mistake me not, though, I will delve into the matter through other parties, and find out the culprit.
Just because I do not feel a threat does not mean it ought to go unpunished.
You think Dulvane will discover the murderer or murderers? Kyrus probed.
No. If anything, Dulvane would be among my suspects, though I doubt he would have done the deeds himself. No, I have my little guild of rats pursuing the matter through more oblique channels. They will find out the comings and goings around the sites of the murders, and narrow the list of who might have been in all three places.
What if they cannot find out?
Then I will pick someone who has not been so cooperative with my regency, and make them the scapegoat, Rashan said, shrugging. Kyrus's eyes widened in surprise.
What? What does that look for? Why would I lie to you if I expect you to carry on in my absence? You need to know these things. I suppose I'm surprised to hear you admit it openly.
The wards will make our conversation gibberish to anyone standing outside. It is just you and me here. You know me for what I am, and have had no qualms yet in working with me.
There is a difference between brutal methods and killing innocents to make a point, Kyrus argued.
Who said anything about killing innocents? Any scrupulous ruler keeps a few guilty men dangling by a thread of hope. It is a form of clemency that is never openly granted, but remains contingent upon not needing to connect a crime and a perpetrator.
Is that what happened with my father? With Brannis's father? Kyrus demanded.
My father is a kindly farmer with a bumpkin's accent, alive and well a half-day's ride from Scar Harbor. For a moment, though, I would have sworn Maruk Solimran was my sire.
No, quite the contrary. The rest of the inner circle are all on a form of parole, as far as I'm concerned. Iridan and Aloysia aside. No, Maruk Solimran, as well as Stelia Gardaris and Gravis Archon, were very much guilty of their crimes. Quite a number outside the inner circle are paroled as well. Your traveling companion Phelan, for one, has earned his clemency in earnest, as has Caladris, without whom I do not think I would have kept a civil war from starting.
What if that was what was started last night?
Well, since you will be in charge here come dawn, I would suggest averting it if possible, and winning it if not.
You are not worried? Kyrus asked.
You are young. I've seen a lot in my time, so I trust that it will all work out in the end. I usually have a hand in ensuring that it does so. Once I crush Magrin and their allies, I will return and deal with any trouble remaining, Rashan said.
Is that the reason for the jovial mood? Kyrus asked, suddenly piecing it together.
Am I in a good mood?
I suppose I am.
Civil war.
The thought haunted Kyrus as he rode down to the waterfront. He had not planned on making his inspection until the morning after the coronation, but ideas were sloshing around in his brain, attempting to coalesce into a plan. It bothered him that Rashan expressed so little concern for the prospect, shrugging responsibility onto Kyrus and merrily heading off to war. By the sound of it, Rashan and Dulvane were going to be conducting parallel investigations into the murders. By Kyrus's reckoning, given Rashan's admission that the victims were supporters of his, the warlock would be seeking the identity of the murderer while Dulvane acted to obscure it or cast suspicion on another.
But if Rashan suspected Dulvane of involvement, why would he not just confront him? He has never seemed shy about such things before.
Kyrus's own conversation with Dulvane Lurien had left little room for misinterpretation. He knew that the houseless sorcerer was aiming to return Kadrin to the rule of the Inner Circle, and not an upstart emperor. He knew he could bring that information to Rashan, and have the demon deal with the matter as he saw fit. The problem was that Kyrus was not certain whom he wished to prevail in the struggle. Dulvane was powerful in his own right, and entrenched in Kadrin politics. He had to be aware of the possibility of a confrontation should anyone betray him. Kyrus could not imagine that Dulvane did not have a contingency in place. Whether it would be enough, he had no way to tell, but he suspected not. Kyrus's new sword belt chafed as it bounced against his hip. There was nothing noteworthy about the blade, but he felt he ought to get into the habit of carrying one. Of late, he felt much more at home among the sorcerers of the circle. It would be best for him to maintain at least the illusion that he was still Sir Brannis, Knight of the Empire,
Whichever side the sorcerers of the Imperial Circle fell on, he wanted the knighthood and the army to fall on his own, whichever side he decided on. The eastern end of the Cadran waterfront was home to the shipwrights that built the vessels of the much-maligned Cadran Navy. With 5 berths, 5 vessels under construction, and nearly 1,000 workers, it rivaled the palace in its orchestrated chaos. Greetings were called out to him from various quarters as he was recognized. It felt good to hear a friendly welcome without wondering about subcontext and ulterior motives. His workforce took pride in the airships and admired him for designing them. When history looked back on the era, they would be the birthplace of the first aerial navy. That historical perspective might have been lost on the more grounded among the workers, but the palpable buzz of that energy pervaded the worksite. "Sir Brannis!" called out a familiar voice. Kyrus turned to see Galloway, Brannis's personal armorer, striding down the gangplank of the newest of Kyrus's designs, the first, actually, since Brannis's hand had described all the others. The Dagger Strike was the first of a new sort of airship. It was entirely unseaworthy. Built around a flat-bottomed ship's skeleton, the hull was plated in steel, slotted with arrow slits, and devoid of sails and rigging of any sort. The latter was no oversight, but rather a change in locomotion. The Dagger Strike was the first vessel that would be powered entirely by ether. Kyrus climbed down from his horse in time to clasp wrists with Galloway when he arrived. Though taller than the armorsmith, Kyrus was nowhere near Galloway's girth. Little of it anything but muscle. The man's grip was like the steel he worked. "Is everything ready?" Kyrus asked.
"Just polishing door handles and the like now, making it pretty for inspection," Galloway replied, beaming with pride.
"Know anything about how the rune work has been going?" Kyrus ventured. There was no reason to expect Galloway to know anything about how the runes worked, but it was not unreasonable to suppose he might have heard how the work was going.
"All finished, near as I can tell. The Circle boys working at it took off 'fore dusk last night, and haven't been back. I can go find one of the superintendents if you'd like, Sir Brannis."
"No, that'll be quite all right, Galloway. I would just like a look around," Kyrus informed him. Armorsmith in tow, he climbed aboard and admired the craftsmanship. There was little wood used in the construction beyond the timbers that gave the vessel its shape. The shipwrights could not work in metal, and the metal workers had no feel for shaping a hull. Future versions would be entirely of metal, once the metalsmiths could learn the shipbuilding trade well enough to get the shape right. Kyrus ran his fingers along the contours of the runes that covered most surfaces of the ship. It was the largest, most intricate pattern. No, system of interconnected patterns, he corrected himself, of any of the airships to date.
"I've heard 'em grumbling, sir. Some of them sorcerers don't think this one will get off the ground. Too heavy. Too many runes for anyone to activate. Not using the wind for power. So, what do you say to that?"
"If you can keep a secret for a few hours," Kyrus said, pausing to wait for Galloway to nod in acknowledgement before continuing. "You can see for yourself."
"I thought it was going to be activated tomorrow."
"Was." Kyrus grinned. Galloway found it contagious. Juliana arrived back at her room with pockets heavier with gold than when she had left that morning. Festival days were always lucrative occasions for a port inspector, if they had the right frame of mind. There were always shipments arriving with critically demanded goods, and men willing to pay extra for theirs to make it through the process more quickly.
"I would not want to trade places with Aloysia. More work and less coin at the end of it, plus a lot of folk poking around at your business."
Juliana was content working occasionally, keeping her own endeavors quieter. The ward on her door took an effort to disengage, which raised her hackles.
"Someone has been in here."
Juliana was inexpert in her ward crafting. It had been Iridan who had carved the runes for their bedchamber. With any luck, it was just Iridan who had been there in her absence. But the ward felt different. It was the same pattern of runes. It had not been recarved or anything so extreme as that.
It was merely infused with more ether than she was accustomed to putting into it when it needed refreshing. She entered the room with a hand under the back of her tunic, on the hilt of adventure. A quick scan in the ether revealed nothing, but she was all too aware that assassins of late had managed to avoid such scrutiny. The space was as disheveled as she remembered leaving it, bedclothes rumpled, jewelry scattered on the bedside table, piles of soiled clothing on the rug. Her black silk formal circle uniform had been laid out on the bed, folded clumsily. She relaxed a bit.
"Someone let the servants in to set out my attire for the evening."
Stranger things had befallen of late, but she could not rule out the possibility that something was seriously amiss. Having left herself little enough time as it was, she decided that she was safe enough to strip out of her working gear and bathe. She had spent the day consorting with the sort of folks who did so infrequently themselves, and hanging about in locales that smelled of fish and ale. She had long since become inured to the odors, but knew that they would stand her in poor company at the ceremony. She was not so important to the proceedings that her presence would be missed if she was a bit late, but coming in reeking of dockside swill would draw attention she preferred to avoid. After an all-too-brief cleansing, she donned enough lavender perfume to cover any lingering odors. She did not use the little bottle of honeysuckle that she knew Brannis remembered, and loved from when they were both younger. That was only for special occasions, not mere coronations. When she picked up her evening attire, she heard a crinkling sound. Turning the garment about, she located the source of the noise, a note stuffed into one of the sleeves. "Skip the reception afterward. Head to the dry docks. Ask for Daggerstrike. I will keep an old promise." The note was written in beautiful Akkadian script, casually scrawled artwork that served as adequate identification for the unsigned note. Juliana pondered for a moment, but knew that she did not have the time right then to puzzle through it. She did, however, reconsider her decision to leave her daggers behind for the coronation. Half the sorcerers in the Empire would be there, ensuring that only suicidal violence would be possible. With the change in plans for immediately afterward, she decided that she would be better off finding a place for them under her formal attire. A quick check in the mirror revealed slight bulges where the harness held adventure and freedom against the small of her back. Brannis's daggers were far superior to the ones she had brought with her to Rainsdark, but they were also a bit bulkier. It would be cold enough at the outdoor ceremony, she decided, that wearing a cloak would not seem inappropriate. Any sorceress worth the title ought to have been able to shield herself against a bit of chill, and Juliana was certainly capable of doing so, but she was enough maligned among the circle for her idleness and lack of ambition that it would not surprise most folk. Juliana made her way across the room and opened a wardrobe. She found it half empty. Missing half her clothing would be a minor inconvenience, but the half that remained was Iridan's, not hers. She hurried to her dresser and began pulling out the drawers. Empty, empty, empty. She looked under the bed and found her spare boots missing as well.
"What have you got in mind, Kyrus? Are we making an escape tonight? If you were going to do it, I would have rather it been the wedding rather than the assassination that gave you the idea."
She went back to the wardrobe and pulled out one of Iridan's cloaks. It did not hang quite low enough for her taste, but it would do. She posed in front of the mirror to be sure, then left for the coronation ceremony of Emperor Somic. There must have been 30 or 40,000 in attendance, Kyrus estimated. The tournament grounds in Cadrus were used all too infrequently, but they had been refurbished in short order upon Rashan's orders. The structure itself was a stepped bowl shape of cut stone blocks, covered with an overhanging wooden roof supported by stone pillars. The roof only covered the outermost half of the seats. The sod field of roughly tended grass and the seats nearest it were exposed to the night sky. The stars themselves would bear witness to the crowning of a new emperor. The grounds had been opened up to anyone in the Empire who wished to attend.
The throng outside attested to how many more wished to witness history than were able to actually get seats. The commoners crowded together on bench seats, packed in so tightly they could scarcely move. Kairos thought back to all the things that Denric and Stalyard had told him about the lot of the peasantry of the Kadrin Empire, as he watched them herded to their seats like cattle to market.
There is only so much room to be had. It's not as if anyone is forcing these conditions on them. They are at least allowed the privilege of attending. More can have that privilege if more are allowed to crowd in together, Kairos told himself from the Solaran section of the reserved seating. The nobles, the sorceress houses, and the circle members, whether they had a house or not, knights and officers of the army, all those were allowed spacious seating, cordoned off from the rabble. He searched the crowd for signs of Juliana. The arrangement of the seating made it difficult, with the Solarans and Archons seated on the same side of the bowl, but not so closely that there was an unobstructed view. His ether vision was mostly useless as well, since the sorcerers of the various blooded houses had sources that ran the full gamut, stronger, weaker, and similar in strength to Juliana's. Picking her out among the commoners would have been easy enough, but finding her among her own family was difficult. Everything that made her stand out in crowds happened to be traits that ran among the Archons, from her height to her source. She even had cousins and older sisters who had their hair colored not so differently from hers.
"Uncle Brannis, I can't see what's going on," a small voice complained beside him.
Through some perversity of humor, it seemed that Axterion had arranged for Danilasis to be seated next to him.
"There's nothing to see yet. Just wait," Kairos told him.
"Can I sit up on your shoulders?" Danil asked, making it sound as easy at nearly 8 summers as it would have been when he was 4.
"You're too big for that now. Just settle in. There's not going to be much to see anyway."
"Then why are so many people here to watch it? They must be expecting to see something good," Danil said.
"When someone is made emperor, they want lots of people to see it. It helps give the emperor legitimacy. Everyone here can personally vouch for having seen him take the crown, and all the people accepting that fact. Most of the people here are just here to be able to tell people they were here. The rest of us are here because it is expected of us. You are old enough now that you are expected to be here as well."
"Who expects us to be here?"
"Everyone else who is expected here.
It is a sort of mutual affair. By coming, we show that we support the new emperor. Anyone who did not come would, in a way, be saying that they did not."
"Why is Grandpa not here, then? Will people think he doesn't support the emperor?"
"No, he's too old for anyone to expect him to travel, even if it is just halfway across Kadrus by carriage," Kairos said. "Try looking around to find all the people you know. Make a list in your head of the ones you do not see. Find them afterward and ask them why they were not here."
"That ought to keep him occupied for a while."
Kairos's plan worked well enough for him to watch what little of a show accompanied the ceremony. A mix of palace guards and an honor guard of soldiers marched into the stadium carrying torches. There was something primal and ancient about bared flames, accentuated by the lack of magical lights as dusk began to fade. After marching out in formation, they spread themselves and lined both sides of a path out to the center of the tournament grounds, which yet more of them encircled in fire. There was a circular stone slab at the very center, which Kairos could see glowing with runes around the outer edge. A hush fell over the crowd. Emerging from the end of the torch-lit line was Somic Highwater, who would shortly become emperor of the Kadrin Empire. He was clad in red and gold velvet, accented in white. His head was bare, ready to receive a crown. Hard though it was to tell from so far away, Kairos thought he looked nervous. Behind him followed two of the most influential figures in the Empire, walking side by side. To his right was Dolvain Lurien, dressed in his inner circle finery, black with red and gold trim. To his left was General Sir Hurald Shadrisson, his ruined armor polished to a shine that glowed orange in the torchlight. Both men were choices of politics rather than true influence. Though Kyrus knew for certain that Dolvain opposed the Emperor's selection, Rashan had ceded the honor of issuing the Circle's blessing to his second-in-command to force Dolvain to publicly endorse him. Kyrus had given his own honor over to his former commander as a peace offering. He knew that Rashan intended him to take over his regency in all but name, so the oversight of the army would fall to Sir Hurald, anyway, unless he chose to replace the man. Lastly came the Imperial Regent, Warlock Rashan Solaran, bearing in his hands the crown that had been worn by the last 12 emperors. It was a golden circlet ringed in golden horns. 4 gems were set equally spaced around it: emerald, ruby, sapphire, diamond. Kyrus knew the last fact from Brannis's history lessons. It was too far to make out what gems might have been set in it. It glowed in the ether as well, prompting him to wonder what powers the crown might possess, if the ether indicated anything more than just preservative magics, that is. The 4 men came to a stop on the stone slab, the Emperor at the center, the other 3 arrayed around him. The purpose of the runes became clear when Rashan began to speak. His voice carried throughout the tournament grounds, reverberating like the roar of a dragon. Kyrus could attest to that from Brannis's experience. "People of Kadrin, we gather today to crown a new emperor, Somik the First. I ask of you, Somik, of House Highwater, are you prepared to accept the mantle of emperor, as is your birthright?" Rashan said, for all to hear and bear witness. "I am." "Does this man have the support of the army?" Rashan asked.
"I give my support, and that of the Imperial Army, to the claim of Somik, of House Highwater," Sir Hurald attested, swearing his fealty and committing the military to back the new emperor.
"Does this man have the support of the sorcerers?" Rashan asked.
"I give my support, and that of the Imperial Circle, to the claim of Somik, of House Highwater," Dolvain Lurien attested.
Kyrus was impressed at the man's acting ability. He gave every indication of sincerity. Kyrus supposed it was how Dolvain had kept his ruse from being accidentally exposed. "From this day forth, let any who speak or act against Emperor Somik be struck down by the might of the Imperial Army, acting as the left hand of the Emperor, or by the might of the Imperial Circle, acting as the right hand of the Emperor." Rashan paused. "As Imperial Regent, I have ruled over the Kadrin Empire this past season as we sought the rightful heir to the throne. As of this moment, I resign the position of Regent, renounce all claim to rulership, and swear my fealty to Emperor Somik, the First. I bestow upon you, my Emperor, the crown of the Kadrin Empire, and with it all rights and powers granted to her Emperor." Somik Highwater knelt at Rashan's feet and accepted the crown as it was placed upon his head. It was awkward and unwieldy upon Somik's head, an ornament destined to the storage vaults until the next grand occasion, unless Somik turned out to be exceedingly vain and insecure. As Somik arose, Sir Hurald and Dolvain knelt. All the torchbearers knelt as well. Of all the men standing below in the field, only Rashan did not kneel. The demon warlock merely bowed his head in acknowledgement. The Emperor turned his back on his entourage and faced the crowded stands, specifically toward the commoners. He held out his arms to them, spread wide.
"My people, it fills me with pride to see what an empire I have inherited. What a fine people to have turned out in such numbers to see me take up the crown. We are an empire at war, beset by many enemies. I will see that this threat is ended. My first order as emperor is this: Warlock Rashan, I hereby command you that, on the morrow, you take personal action to bring war to Magrin and her allies, that you use that terrible sword of yours to make them suffer for their transgression against us."
"As you command," Rashan replied for all to hear. Kyrus wondered how much of that little speech was written for him by the warlock.
"But that is tomorrow. Tonight, we celebrate,"
Emperor Somik proclaimed, signaling the official end of the ceremony. The crowd cheered.
There was to be a grand procession of carriages across the city to the palace, where the revelry would stretch into the deep hours of the night. That procession was a time Kairos had plans to make use of. Pushing his way through the crowd, Kairos muttered about having matters to attend to. For most who were able to make room, that vague excuse was enough to let Brannis Solaran pass. Warlock Rashan's lieutenants were not known for making their motives plain, and Brannis was known to be well above that rank in Rashan's personal hierarchy. By the time the crowd began filtering out into the streets to either join or watch the procession, Kairos was already at the front of the pack. He disappeared from the crowd as quietly as he was able. Juliana had sat uneasily through the coronation. She saw Brannis searching the crowd for her, but could hardly find an inconspicuous method of drawing attention to herself without drawing attention to herself. Brannis, of course, had been easy to spot. Just shifting into the ether and looking for the blinding light was all it took. In fact, Juliana would not be surprised if many sorcerers had to forego enjoying the view in the ether during the ceremony because of the distractingly painful glare from Brannis's source. A tiny voice in her head had reminded her that Brannis was now really Kairos, and that Brannis was off in Tellurak with Soria, but she had hushed it and told the voice that it did not matter. Juliana had tried to keep her focus on the ceremony itself, which had been thankfully brief. There were too many thoughts bubbling in her head. Aloysia's accusation, or at least near accusation, had been the first item to put her on edge. She had initially heard of the murders with a detached curiosity, the sort that comes easily when you can see no connection between an event and how it affects you. After the chat with Brannis's sister, she had been trying to find a motive for the killings that would fit with the intrigues Aloysia hinted at, or the machinations of the Magrin, who had already tried two assassinations previously. Down by the waterfront, her seafaring acquaintances were no help to her state of mind, having all manner of theories on the deaths of the three sorcerers. The cryptic note and the emptiness of her bedchamber had only served to add a layer to the mystery. She just did not know quite what it was. The crowd carried Juliana along toward the exits. She made no effort to speed the process, allowing herself to blend in among the sorcerers, dressed nearly identically in black, save a few rank insignia and the differences between the men's and women's attire. Once the crowd oozed her out onto the streets, she flowed to the edges of the group and disappeared down a side street. Feast nights drew thieves and cutthroats like flies to a corpse. They lurked at the edges of crowds, waiting for errant merrymakers to wander away from the safety of guards and numbers. Juliana activated a shield once she was well away from the bulk of the realm's sorcerers. After that, any cutthroat would merely pose a delay, a straightforward problem on a day where she had her fill of mysteries. An attack would have been a welcome diversion, a problem she knew exactly how to handle. Despite her misgivings, the thieves and worse among the Cadrus underworld were either lucky or smart that night. She arrived at the waterfront without incident, but was unfamiliar with the dry docks. Of all the parts of the waterfront, it was the place least in need of someone to oversee cargo arriving. There were only two places ships went where they never needed such an inspection: the dry docks where they originated, and the sea floor where they eventually all wound up. There was more activity than she would have expected at so late an hour on a day of celebration. She would have expected the workers to be among the revelers drinking themselves stupid over the crowning of a new emperor. She did not know the names of any of the new ships that were being built, so she had to ask someone which the dagger strike was. "The metal ship with no masts. You can't miss it, girl," one of them informed her. When she found it, it looked even stranger than any airship she had seen so far. The modifications to most just involved a lot of runes, some extra rigging to keep crewmen from falling off as they pitched and rolled in the air, and a steering sail. The Dagger Strike looked like a ship dipped in molten metal, hot enough to burn away masts, rigging, and rudder. It looked incomplete, heavy, and unlikely to float either on water or in the air.
There you are.
Good.
Quickly, get up here, she heard Brannis call down from above. She looked up and saw him on the deck, leaning over the railing. Juliana looked around and found the gangplank. She took Brannis' advice and rushed up to meet him on the deck. Brannis put his arm around her and hurried her down below decks, lighting a soft blue light as they went. Juliana could not help but marvel at how nearly every metallic surface was covered in runes. Brannis pulled her into a room at the end of the corridor that turned out to be a bedchamber.
Brannis, if this is what you wanted, you could...
No, it is not like that, Brannis replied. These are your new quarters.
My what?
Juliana shouted. Brannis pantomimed quiet by patting his hands downward in the air. Things here are going to get messy in Cadrus very soon. You've seen a piece of the puzzle, unless you've been oblivious to the rumors about the murdered sorcerers. I'm fairly certain that there is a civil war beginning. You are a perfect target for such intrigues, Brannis said, holding up a hand that forestalled an objection before she could voice it. I know you take care of yourself far better than anyone here credits you with. That said, I have a good, legitimate use for these same skills. I have it worked out perfectly.
What perfect plan would that be? Juliana asked. I remember your plan from Rainsdark, which...
No, that was Brannis's plan, Brannis said.
Kyrus, Juliana reminded herself. I keep telling you they are not the same.
I have thought this through well enough. I want you to captain the dagger strike. I have no need of sailors on this ship, I've realized. This is a ship to be run by a sorcerer, or a sorceress in this particular case. I've written up all the appropriate orders to promote you to a naval captain, assign you a crew, and relieve you of your current circle commitments.
I am not certain you were authorized for all that, Juliana replied, raising a skeptical eyebrow.
That is the beauty of the plan. You are leaving tonight. Not very long from now, in fact. By the time you are gone, you will be unreachable to rescind any orders. Before anyone can make any serious effort to recall you, I will have all the authority I need. Rashan arranged for Emperor Somic to send him off to war. The bloodthirsty bastard cannot wait to free himself of the shackles of politics. He told me that he will arrange for me to be left in charge, to take his place tomorrow when he departs for Magrin, or at least the parts of Cadrin that are under their control now.
Wait, what about the Emperor? Rashan is free to go because there is an Emperor now to take care of all the politics.
No, the Emperor is a fool. Rashan wants me running things in his absence, not Emperor Somic. I trust he will arrange it so that happens.
What about this ship, then? I know nothing about captaining a ship, and this thing doesn't look close to getting off the ground, Juliana protested, knowing that it would not change anything.
She loved hearing Brannis's convoluted mental acrobatics. It was among her favorite things about him. The ship is ready to fly. It just needs ether to get it started. I will empower it momentarily. I just wanted to wait until you were ready to depart. I think it may draw a small amount of attention. I will show you everything you need to command the ship. It is as simple to use as I could think to make it. As for the captaining part, you already run a small crew of mercenaries in Tellurak. Plus, you've been aboard a number of ships. You've seen how captains act.
But what do I do once I leave? I'm not a battle commander.
No, but you are a mercenary. I do not want the dagger strike within a cannon's range of a real battle. I want you to cause havoc. Ambush supply caravans, pick off scouting parties, strike remote garrisons, that sort of thing. I shall leave the details entirely to your judgment and discretion. Juliana got a quick tutoring on everything she would need to know about the controls for the ship, how to steer it, how to make it climb or dive, everything from the gangplanks to the hidden hatches in the sides to disgorge corsairs was all commanded by the captain from one of several points on the ship that would accept commands. When he felt she knew all she would need to get her started, Brannis shooed her off the ship. I will need to draw a lot of ether to get this monster started. Best not to be too close, Brannis warned. Juliana retreated to the ground, where she found her crew gathered, awaiting orders.
She met her new first mate and officers, all of whom were Army, not Navy. They made introductions as Juliana felt alarming amounts of ether flowing to the interior of the ship. The nearest sensation she had ever felt was being there in the mines of Rainsdark when Jinzan Fair had used the staff of Galen. As the draw ended, the ship began to crackle with energy, and a throbbing, pulsating hum emanated from the steel hull. "Everything is ready. It took," Brennus called down to her as he descended the gangplank. He looked haggard. "You should all get aboard and get going. Head out to sea a bit before looping around out of sight of the city. I have to get back to the palace before my presence is too sorely missed."
"Brennus, you never promised me a ship of any sort or a command of my own. What promise were you referring to, keeping in your note?"
"Bran, I gave you adventure and freedom," he said, nodding in the direction of where she kept her dragon-tooth daggers. It might have been a sweet gesture, but it was ultimately a hollow one. It was cheating. "Now I am giving you adventure and freedom, the proper sort this time." She did not care that it was in front of her entire new crew. She crushed Brannis.
"Okay, Kyrus,"
in her arms, and kissed him before she took her leave. The dagger strike lifted effortlessly at her command, holding the ship's wheel just as Kyrus had shown her. The thrills of adventure and freedom awaited.